The work on the boat suggested that the men would not march out through the town gates. And yet, Gage might have ordered this work done merely to confuse the people of Boston, blind them to his real direction. The talk at Dr. Warren's went on into the night. Johnny relaxed on a sofa in the surgery as the men talked. He was ready to run wherever sent, find out any fact for them. It was past midnight. He would not have known he had been asleep except that he had been dreaming. He had been hard at work down on Hancock's wharf, boiling lobsters, he and John Hancock and Sam Adams. The lobsters had men's eyes with long lashes and squirmed and looked up piteously. Hancock would avert his sensitive face to their distress. "Go away, please." But he kept pushing them under with his gold-headed cane. Sam Adams would rub his palms and chuckle. Johnny woke up and realized that only Revere and Warren were still in the room, and they were talking about Hancock and Adams. These two gentlemen had left Boston in March. They were representatives at the Provincial Congress at Concord. The British had forbidden the General Court to meet, but the Massachusetts men had merely changed the name of their legislative body and gone on sitting. But did the British know that both these firebrands were staying at the Clarks out in Lexington? "It will do no harm to warn them," Revere was saying, getting to his feet. "I'll row over to Charlestown tonight, go to Lexington, and tell them a sizable force may soon move. They had best hide themselves for the next few days, and get word to Concord. The cannons and stores had best be hidden." "Of course." "Tell them we here in Boston have the situation well in hand. The second the troops move, either on foot or into those boats, we will send them warning in time to get the Minutemen into the field. I'd give a good deal to know which way they are going." "But suppose none of us can get out. Gage knows we'd send word if we could. He may guard the town so well it will be impossible." Johnny was still half awake. He yawned and settled back to think of those lobsters. With eyes like men, long lashes, tears on their lashes. Revere was pulling on his gloves. "Colonel Conant in Charlestown. I'll tell him to watch the spire of Christ's Church. You can see it well from Charlestown. If the British go out over the neck, we will show one lantern. If in the boats, two. And come hell or high water, I'll do my best to get out and tell exactly what's acting. But I may get caught on my way over. Another man should also be ready to try to get out through the gates." They talked to various men and finally pitched upon Billy Dawes. He could impersonate anybody, from a British general to a drunken farmer. This might help him get through the gates. As Paul Revere, with Johnny at his heels, left Warren's, a man emerged from the darkness, laid a hand on Revere's arm. In the little light, Johnny recognized the rolling black eye, poetic negligence of dress. It was Dr. Church. "Paul," he whispered, "what's afoot?" "Nothing," said Revere shortly and went on walking. "The British preparing to march." "Why don't you ask them?" The queer man drifted away. Johnny was surprised that Revere would tell Church nothing, for he was in the very inner circle. Seemingly Revere himself was surprised by his sudden caution. "But I can't trust that fellow, never have, never will." 2. The 16th of April. All over Boston, bells were calling everyone to church. As though they had not a care in the world, the British officers crowded into the Episcopal churches and army chaplains held services for the soldiers in the barracks. Paul Revere was over on the mainland carrying out his mission. Boston looked so usual and so unconcerned, Johnny began to wonder if they all had not made mountains out of molehills, imagined an expedition when none was intended. But Rab was so certain the time was close at hand that he told Johnny that he himself was leaving Boston for good. There would be fighting before the week was out, and he intended to be in it. Now he must report at Lexington. Johnny took this news badly. He could not endure that Rab should leave him, desert him. But as soon as the first shot is fired, no man of military age can possibly get out of Boston. They'll see to it. It's now or never. He did not seem to feel any grief at abandoning Johnny, who sat disconsolately on his bed watching Rab. The older boy was cutting himself a final piece of bread and cheese. How many hundreds of times Johnny had seen those strong white teeth tearing at coarse bread? Rab had been eating bread and cheese all through their first meeting, and that was long ago. It seemed he'd be eating bread and cheese to the end. There was a sick qualm at the pit of Johnny's stomach. He couldn't eat bread and cheese, and it irritated him that Rab could. The older boy was glowing with good health, good spirits. He was 18, 6 feet tall, and a grown man. He looked it as he moved about the low attic, stuffing his pockets with extra stockings, rolling up a shirt in a checkered handkerchief. "He's leaving me, and he doesn't care," thought Johnny. "Perhaps I'll go, too," he offered, hoping Rab would say, "I'd give everything I've got, even my musket, if you could come." Or merely, "Fine, come along." "No, you can't," said Rab. "You've got your work to do right here in town. You stick around with your fat friend Dove." "Gosh, I'm glad I'll never have to listen to Dove again." "But you'll have a fine time with Dove while I..." "You know I cannot stomach Dove." "No? I thought he and you were getting on fine together." "And there's not one reason why I can't leave for Lexington, too, except you don't want me." He knew this was not true, but he could not help badgering Rab, trying to make him say, "I'll miss you as much as you'll miss me." Rab laughed at him. He was going to leave, and he wasn't going to be slopped over. Johnny was gazing at him sullenly. Rab took the extra stockings from his pocket, untied his handkerchief, and added them to his shirt and other necessities. "You want to go," Johnny accused him. "Yes." "Well, then go. I'm going as fast as I'm able." "Oh, Rab, Rab. Have you ever seen those little eyes at the end of a musket? Rab, don't you go. Don't you go." Rab was singing under his breath. It was the song of the Lincolnshire poacher that Mr. Revere had taught Johnny and Johnny had taught Rab. There was something about Rab's singing, low, a little husky, and not too accurate, that always moved Johnny. It was a part of that secret fire which came out in fighting, taking chances, and dancing with girls. The excitement glowed in Rab's eyes now. He was going into danger. He was going to fight, and the thought made some dark part of him happy. Johnny wanted to tell him about those eyes, but instead he said, "I guess you really want to go out to Lexington and do some more dancing." "Here's hoping." From then on, Johnny said nothing, sitting glumly on his bed, his head bowed. Then Rab came over to him and put a hand on his shoulder. "Goodbye, Johnny. I'm off." Johnny did not look up. "You're a bold fellow, Johnny Tremaine." He was laughing. Johnny heard Rab's feet going down the ladder. The door of the shop closed after him. He ran to look out the window. Rab was standing outside the Lorne house, shaking hands with his uncle, saying goodbye like a grown man. Now he was bending down to kiss Aunt Jennifer. Not at all like a small boy kissing an aunt. He picked up Rabbit, who could toddle about, and kissed him, too. Then, half running, he passed lightly up Salt Lane and out of sight. One moment too late, Johnny ran out into the alley. He couldn't let Rab go like that. He had not even said, "Good luck. God be with you." Why, he might not ever see Rab again. He went back to his garret and flung himself on his bed. He half wished he might cry and was half glad he was too old for tears. Today there was no sound from the shops and wharves. No cry of chimney sweep, oysterman, knife grinder. The town was whist and still, for it was Sunday. As Johnny lay upon his bed, the church bells began to call for afternoon service. They babbled softly as one old friend to another. Christ's Church and the Cockerel, Old South, Old Meeting, Hollis, King's Chapel. He knew every one. He had heard them clanging furiously for fire, crying fiercely to call out the Sons of Liberty. He had heard them toll for the dead, rejoice when some unpopular act had been repealed, and shudder with bronze rage at tyranny. They had wakened him in the morning and sent him to bed at night, but he never loved them more than on Lord's days when their golden clamor seemed to open the blue vaults of heaven itself. You could almost see the angels bending down to earth, even to rowdy old Boston. "Peace, peace," the soft bells said. "We are at peace." Suddenly, close by, over at the Afra Queen, the British drumsticks fell. The fifes struck up, "Two, two, toodly-two." Even on Sunday they were out drilling. So were other men, even on Sunday. For instance, over in Lexington. The 16th of April drew to a close. Monday was a quiet day. Lieutenant Stranger looked very solemn. Maybe there was not to be an expedition after all. 3. The 18th of April. By afternoon, the sergeants were going about the town, rounding up the grenadier and light infantry companies, telling them in whispers to report at moonrise at the bottom of the common, equipped for an expedition. The sergeants would tap their red noses with their fingers and bid the men be whist, but it was common knowledge in the barracks and on the streets that 700 men would march that night. This very night, come darkness, the men would move, but in what direction? And who would be in charge of the expedition? Surely not more than one of the colonels would be sent. Johnny, who had his own colonel to watch, Colonel Smith, hardly left the Afro Queen all day and helped the potboy serve drinks to the officers in the dining room. A young officer sitting with Stranger did say, as he stirred his brandy and water with his thumb, that he hoped before long thus to stir Yankee blood. And what of that? Colonel Smith did have an army chaplain to dine with him that day. Did that mean he was suddenly getting religious, as people are said to before they go into danger? Of one thing Johnny was sure. Dove knew much less than he did. Dove was so thick-witted he had no idea anything unusual was afoot. He honestly believed that the grenadiers and light infantry were merely going to be taught new evolutions. As usual, Dove was too wrapped in his own woes to think much of what was happening about him. By 5, Johnny thought he would leave the Queen and report to Paul Revere that he had discovered nothing new. First, one more glance at Dove. For once, he found him hard at work, his lower lip stuck out, his whitish pig lashes wet. He was polishing a saddle. "That guy," he complained, "hit me for nothing. He said I was to get to work on his campaign saddle." "Who's he?" "Colonel Smith, of course."
"Did you do as he told you?"
"I tried. I didn't know he had two saddles. So I went to work on the usual one. I shined it until you can see your face in it. And he takes it out of my hands and he hit me on the head with it. Says I'm a stupid lout not to know the difference between a parade saddle and a campaign saddle. How'd I know? Why, he's been over here about a year and that campaign saddle hasn't even been unpacked. I had to get it from Lieutenant Stranger. How'd I know?" Johnny said nothing. He realized he had heard something which conceivably might be important. "Careful. Careful, don't you say anything to scare him. Where's your polish? I'll help you with the stirrups." The instant Johnny went to work, Dove, as usual, lay back on the hay. One of the stirrups wrapped around my head, cut my ear, bled something fierce. Johnny was studying the saddle on his knees. It was of heavy black leather, brass, not silver mountings. 3 girths instead of 2. All sorts of hooks and straps for attaching map cases, spy glasses, flasks, kits of all sorts. Colonel Smith is going on a campaign. But perhaps not. He might merely be riding down to New York. He leaned back on his heels. "Say, what if you and I took time out to eat supper? The Queen's cook has promised me a good dinner because I helped them at table this afternoon. Roast goose. And I'll fix it so you can get in on it, too." "Oh, for goodness sake, no. It's past 5 o'clock. Colonel can't be going anywhere tonight." "Oh, for land's sake, Johnny. He says I'm to show him that saddle by 6 sharp, and if he don't like its looks, he's going to cut me to mincemeat. He's always saying things like that. He's the..." Johnny did not listen to what Colonel Smith was. He was thinking. "Well, after that, when Colonel Smith has settled down to play whist, can you get off?" "Tonight isn't like any other night. He told me to bring Sandy around for him, fed and clean and saddled with his old campaign saddle by 8 o'clock tonight." "Colonel Smith is going on a long journey, starting tonight at 8. It might be a campaign." He had an idea. "I should think if the colonel was making a long trip, he'd take Nan. She's so light and easy to ride if he has far to go." "He does like her better. She don't jounce as fat so. He always rides her around Boston, but only yesterday he had Lieutenant Stranger take her over to the common when the men were drilling. Stranger says she still is squirmy when she hears drums and shooting. I heard him say so." "Oh. Drums and shooting. This was not to be a peaceful ride to, say, New York." His cloth whipped over the black saddle leather. He spat on it and rubbed even harder. The one thing he must not say was the wrong thing. Nothing was better than the wrong thing. so for a while he said nothing.
Sandy's good as gold, but he's an old horse and a little stiff. His front leg won't last forever.
Colonel Smith didn't say he was going off on him forever.
This did not help much, but Dove went on.
He and the horse doctor and Lieutenant Stranger were all looking at him just this morning. The horse doctor said old Sandy could do 30 miles easy, and Stranger said no, he wouldn't swear he could get Nan on and off a boat without her fussing.
So the campaign would start around 8 that night. The colonel's horse would be put on and off a boat. There would be a risk at least of drums and shooting. They were not going farther than 30 miles. Those men who thought the target of the expedition was going to be Lexington and Concord were right. And it would be Colonel Smith who would go in command. All Johnny's hidden excitement went into his polishing. The brass mountings turned to gold, the black leather to satin.
There, you take that in and show your colonel.
But he would wait one moment more. Dove might have something more to say when he came back after he had seen the colonel.
Johnny went into Goblin's stall, but the horse pretended not to know him and put back his ears and nipped at him.
Sandy next. The big yellow horse carefully moved over to give him room in the stall, nickered a little. He fondled the broad white-striped face, pulled gently at the ears, little furry ears lost in mane like a pony's.
"I guess," Johnny said, "looks like you'll be seeing that rab before I do. Maybe in Lexington. You tell that rab he'd best look sharp. Take good care of himself. Tell that rab..."
"Oh, anything." Dove came back in a jubilee.
"Colonel says I've done a fine job, and so quick he's going to give me tomorrow as a holiday. He don't expect to get back before night."
Certainly this campaign was going to be a short one, if everything went as the British expected. 4.
"It is tonight, all right," Johnny said to Dr. Warren, "and Colonel Smith will command."
He went on to tell what he had found out from Dove. That the expedition would start tonight, and that Lexington and Concord were the likely objects, the men sitting around in Warren's surgery had already guessed. But they were interested to learn that the colonel, and presumably his troops, expected to return to Boston the day after they set out, and that he was to command them. Seemingly Gage, a punctilious man, had chosen Francis Smith because he had been in service longer than any of the other and smarter colonels.
"Hark!"
Outside the closed window on Tremont Street, a small group of soldiers were marching stealthily toward the common. These were the first they heard. But soon after, another group marched past, then another. A man whose duty it was to watch the British boats at the foot of the common came in to say he had actually seen the men getting into the boats, heading for Cambridge. Dr. Warren turned to Johnny. "Run to Ann Street. Bid Billy Dawes come to me here, ready to ride. Then go to North Square. I've got to talk to Paul Revere before he starts. Both he and Dawes will be expecting a messenger." Billy Dawes was in his kitchen. He was a homely, lanky, young fellow with close-set eyes and a wide, expressive mouth. He and his wife had dressed him for the part he would play, a drunken farmer. His wife, who looked more like a schoolgirl than a serious matron, could not look at him without going from one giggling fit to another. She laughed even more, and Billy joined her when Johnny came in and said the time had come. The young man stuck a dilapidated hat with a broken feather on his head, and his wife picked up a bottle of rum and poured it over the front of his torn jacket. Then she kissed him and they both laughed. As he stood before them, his expression changed. His eyes went out of focus. His grin became foolish. He hiccuped and swayed. He both looked and smelled like a drunken farmer. But he did have money in his pocket which no country blade would have had after a big toot in town. He knew one of the soldiers guarding the neck that night. He believed he'd get out all right. The scene in the Dawes' kitchen was so light-hearted and so comical, and Johnny as well as little Mrs. Dawes laughed so hard, he wondered if she had any idea of the risk her husband was running. For by any law of any land, a man caught exciting to armed rebellion might be shot. The second the door closed after the young man, Johnny knew. Mrs. Dawes stood where her husband had left her, all laughter wiped from her face. Billy Dawes was not the only gifted actor in his family. From Ann Street, Johnny ran toward North Square. This he found crowded with light infantry and grenadier companies, all in full battle dress. They got in his way, and he in theirs. One of the men swore and struck at him with his gun butt. The regulars were getting ugly. He could not get to the Revere's front door, but by climbing a few fences he reached their kitchen door and knocked softly. Paul Revere was instantly outside in the dark with him.
"Johnny," he whispered, "the Somerset has been moved into the mouth of the Charles. Will you run to Copp's Hill and tell me if they have moved in any of the other warships? I think I can row around one, but three or four might make me trouble. I'll go look. Wait. Don't go to Robert Newman, you know, the Christ's Church sexton. He lives with his mother opposite the church."
"I know. They have British officers billeted on them.
Don't rap at that door. Take this stick. Walk by the house slowly, limping, tapping with the stick until the light in an upper window goes out. Then go round to the alley behind the house. Tell Newman the lanterns are to be hung now. Two of them. He knows what to do."
As Johnny stood among the graves of lonely Copp's Hill looking across the broad mouth of the Charles, he could see lights in the houses of Charlestown. And over there he knew men were watching Boston, watching Christ's lofty spire, waiting for the signal. And as soon as they saw it, the best and fastest horse in Charlestown would be saddled and made ready for Paul Revere, who had himself promised to get over, if possible. Ride and spread the alarm. Summon the Minutemen. He watched the riding lights on the powerful 64-gun Somerset. The British had evidently thought her sufficient to prevent boats crossing the river that night. She was alone. The moon had risen, the tide was rising, the Somerset was winding at her anchor. The night was unearthly sweet. It smelled of land and of the sea, but most of all it smelled of spring. Salem Street, where the Newmans lived like North Square, was filled with soldiers. The redcoats were assembling here, getting ready to march down to the common. And they would be a little late. Their orders were to be ready by moonrise. A sergeant yelled at Johnny as he started to limp past them, but when he explained in a piteous whine that his foot had been squashed by a blow from a soldier's musket, and all he wanted was to get home to his mama, an officer said the men were to let the child pass. Johnny was 16, but he could pull himself together and play at being a little boy still. Downstairs in the Newman house, he could look in and see a group of officers as usual, almost as always, playing at cards. Their jackets were unbuttoned, their faces flushed. They were laughing and drinking. There was, on the second floor, one light. Johnny couldn't believe anyone up there could hear him tapping in the street below. Instantly, the light went out. He had been heard. Newman, a sad-faced young man, got out at a second-story window and back, ran across a shed roof, and was in the alley waiting for Johnny.
"One or two," he whispered. "Two."
That was all. Robert Newman seemed to melt away in the dark. Johnny guessed what the little tinkle was he heard. Newman had the keys to Christ's Church in his hand. The two friends, Paul Revere and Joseph Warren, were standing in the doctor's surgery. They were alone. Revere was urging Warren to cross with him that very night to Charlestown. If there was fighting tomorrow, Gage would not hesitate to hang him, at last, for high treason. But Warren said no. He would stay and keep track of the British plans until the very last moment. "The second a shot has been fired, I'll send a messenger to you," Revere promised. "I'll wait until then." "Why, Revere, I never saw you worry about anything before. I'll be a lot safer tonight than you'll be, catching crabs out on that river, being shot at by the Somerset, and falling off horses. I'll not forget you and Parson Tomley's ambling jade." He was always ragging Revere about falling off horses. It was some old joke between them which Johnny did not know, and both the men suddenly began to laugh. The mood between them had been heavy when Johnny came in, but now it lightened. They parted as casually as any friends who believe they will meet in a few days. But each knew the other was in deadly peril of his life. It was 10 o'clock. Dr. Warren told his colored man to make up a bed for Johnny in the surgery. The boy could not think of bed. He stole down to the common to see the secret embarkation. It was almost over and was no secret. Hundreds of townsfolk stood about silently watching the boats returning from Cambridge shore and taking on yet another scarlet-coated cargo. But where these men were heading, and who commanded them, scarce a man in the crowd knew except Johnny. Farther down the river he knew the Somerset was on guard. By now Paul Revere was in his boat, trying to steal around her. In Charlestown the horse waited for him. He saw Sandy step into a boat with never a quiver. He recognized Lieutenant Stranger's own horse, and for a moment saw the young man's dark face in the moonlight. Being a horse-minded boy, he noticed that there was a little trouble with the showy white horse built like Sandy, but much younger. This was Major Pitcairn's. Were the Marines being sent as well as the Grenadiers and Light Infantry Companies? Or was the rough, genial, stout-hearted old Major merely going along for the fun of it? At least, he felt this observation important enough to report to Warren. Other spies had been bringing news of embarkation. It had been noticed that Pitcairn was not in his usual tavern. He had been seen with a civilian cape wrapped about him heading for the common. Doubtless he was going. Gage had sent him either because he knew he was a better officer than Colonel Smith, or because he had a way with Yankees. Everyone liked the pious, hard-swearing, good-tempered Major Pitcairn. A barmaid from Hull Street came in to say she had been watching the Somerset at just the time Bentley and Richardson were rowing Paul Revere to Charlestown. Not a shot had been fired. It was also known that Billy Dawes had woven and bribed his inebriated way past the guards on the neck. And the horse he was leading and pretending to try to sell had not looked like much, a thin, bony beast in a bridle patched with rope. It was one of the fastest horses in Boston. Then Dr. Warren told Johnny to lie down and get some sleep. It was almost midnight. Johnny took off his jacket and boots, rolled up in a blanket on the bed the black man had made for him. The night before and the night before that he had been much upset over Rab's leaving. His thoughts had turned to the empty bed beside him. He had slept badly. Although people were still about the surgery, exchanging ideas, trying to guess what the future might be, he immediately fell asleep. It was dawn. He was alone in the surgery and still sleeping. But out in Lexington, on the village green, the first shot was fired. One shot, and then a volley. And Major Pitcairn was saying, "Disperse, ye rebels! Ye villains, disperse! Why don't ye lay down your arms?" The war had begun. It was the dawn of the 19th of April. But Johnny Tremaine still slept. Chapter 11. Yankee Doodle. So Johnny slept. It was daylight when he woke with Warren's hand upon his shoulder. Outside on Tremont Street he could hear the clumping of army boots. A sergeant was swearing at his men. The soldiers were paraded so close to the house, which stood flush with the sidewalkless street, that Johnny at first thought they must be in the room. Dr. Warren dared speak no louder than a whisper. "I'm going now." "Something's happened?" "Yes." He motioned Johnny to follow him into the kitchen. This room was on the back of the house. They could talk without danger of being overheard by the troops in the street. Dr. Warren had on the same clothes as the day before. He had not been to bed. But now his hat was on his head. His black bag of instruments and medicines was packed on the table. Silently he put milk, bread, herrings beside it, and gestured to Johnny to join him. "Where did it begin?" asked Johnny. "Lexington." "Who won?" "They did. 700 against 70. It wasn't a battle, it was just target practice for them. Some of our men were killed, and the British huzzaed and took the road to Concord." "And did they get our supplies there?" "I don't know. Paul Revere sent for me just after the firing on Lexington Green." The young man's usually fresh-colored face was haggard. He knew the seriousness of this day for himself and for his country. "But everywhere the alarm is spreading. Men are grabbing their guns, marching for Concord. Paul Revere did get through in time last night. Billy Dawes a little later. Hundreds, maybe thousands of Minutemen are on the march. Before the day's over there'll be real fighting, not target practice. But Gage doesn't know that it's begun. You see, long before Colonel Smith got to Lexington, just as soon as he heard that Revere had warned the country, he sent back for reinforcements, for Earl Percy. You and I, Johnny, are just about the only people in Boston who know that blood has already been shed."
"Were many killed at Lexington?"
"No, not many. They stood up. Just a handful. The British fired on them. It was dawn." Johnny licked his lips.
"Did they tell you the names of those killed?"
"No. Did Rab get out in time?"
"Yes, last Sunday."
The doctor's clear blue eyes darkened. He knew what was in Johnny's mind. He picked up his bag. "I've got to get to them. They'll need surgeons. Then, too, I'd rather die fighting than on a gallows. Gage won't be so lenient now, soon as he learns war has begun."
"Wait until I get my shoes on."
"No, Johnny.
You are to stay here today. Pick up for me any information. For instance, out of my bedroom window, I can see soldiers standing the length of the street way over to the common. You find out what regiments are being sent, and all that. And today, go about and listen to what folk are saying, and the names of any of the British arrest. We know Gage expects to move his men back here tonight. If so, there'll be a lot of confusion getting them into town. You watch your chance and slip out to me. Where'll I find you?
God knows. Ask about.
I will do so.
They've begun it. We'll end it, but this war, it may last quite a long time.
They shook hands silently. Johnny knew that Warren was always conscious of the fact that he had a crippled hand. Everybody else had accepted and forgotten it. The back door closed softly. Warren was gone. Johnny went to the surgery, put on his boots and jacket. The wall clock said 8 o'clock. It was time to be about. There was no leaving by the front door. The soldiers were leaning against it. Through the curtains of the windows he could see the muskets. He noticed the facings on their uniforms. The 23rd Regiment. The narrow course of Tremont Street was filled to the brim and overflowing with the waiting scarlet-coated men. Like a river of blood. He left by the kitchen. 2. On Cornhill, Johnny could feel the subdued excitement. Everyone knew something was happening. No one knew what. Doors and windows were open. People hanging out, calling back and forth, or gathered in knots on the street. Johnny kept his eyes and ears open. Everyone knew about that secret expedition last night. Colonel Smith had embarked with 700 men and landed in Cambridge. That Gage was sending over at least 1,000 fresh troops to support him, anyone might guess. But the people of Boston knew no more than Gage that the fighting had begun. Johnny went to the province house. All was as usual. The sentries were on guard, young officers lounged about. One was already in his cups. Johnny could see that a group of them were playing at cards in the south parlor. Perhaps they were finishing off the game they had begun last night. He knew which was General Gage's bedroom. The curtains were still drawn. Colonel Smith's early call for reserves evidently had not upset the commanding officer. He had given the order which set Percy's 1st Brigade in motion, had rolled over and gone to sleep. Johnny went to the common. He had already seen the tail of Percy's brigade lashing around Dr. Warren's house. The head of this scarlet dragon lay upon the common. The men were restless, grumbling, spitting, shifting their heavy equipment. Some had already been standing about for 3 hours. Johnny learned from one of their camp women what was causing the delay. They were waiting to be joined by a detachment of Marines. He looked about and saw for himself these 1,200 men were taking with them cannon and baggage wagons. The tension among the inhabitants was growing. What had happened? What was going to happen? Shops and schools were closed, and Johnny met a wreath of tiny children advancing and chanting, "School's done, war's begun." It looked to him they were shrewder guessers than their elders, who were trying to believe that not a shot had been or would be fired. Then, from over North Boston way, came the brisk rattle of drums. The 500 Marines, billeted all about North Square, arrived at double-quick. They took their places in the ranks. Some were still buckling their equipment or eating the bread that had been tossed to them. They had been hours late, but when they had been notified, they came fast. Tagging after them, looking half-awake and half-dressed, Johnny recognized an old acquaintance. It was Madge, even fatter since her marriage and seemingly more in love than ever. Tears streamed down her thick red cheeks, and, all old animosity forgotten, she flung herself upon Johnny.
"I can't bear it, but he says he's got to go."
Nearby, tough little Sergeant Gale was strutting about like a bantam cock, roaring at one of his men whose buttons did not shine. He was pretending not to know that his wife was so nearby. He was really showing off in front of her and approved her presence. Men went to war and women wept. All was as it should be. "Sure, he's got to go," Johnny comforted Madge. "But people say Gage is just sending out the brigade for exercise. They've been sitting about barracks catching fleas all winter." "Why were the Marines late?" "Gage sent a letter to Major Pitcairn telling him to parade his men, but Pitcairn wasn't to home." "Pitcairn went off last night, second in command to Colonel Smith." Did you know that? The Marines didn't know until about 10 minutes ago.
Johnny had to laugh. It certainly would hearten Dr. Warren when he heard how stupid the British had been. Gage had forgotten the Marine Major had already gone, had sent him a letter, and then turned over for another snooze. Suddenly there was silence along the whole great length of the brigade. Slim Earl Percy on a white horse, escorted by a group of officers, was cantering slowly across the common. 5 mounted men. The sun was bright that day, with only breeze enough to ruffle the horses' manes, flaunt scarlet riding capes, float the flag of England. Johnny was an Englishman. The sullen, rebellious people standing about watching Percy and his staff approaching, waiting for the brigade to march, all were Englishmen. That flag, it stood for Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, Charles I's head upon a block, centuries of struggle for English liberty. But over here there had grown up a broader interpretation of the word liberty. No man to be ruled or taxed except by men of his own choice. But we are still fighting for English liberty, and don't you forget it. French slaves to the north of us, Spanish slaves to the south. Only English colonies are allowed to taste the forbidden fruit of liberty, we who grew up under England. Johnny thought of James Otis's words, upholding the torch of liberty, which had been lighted on the fires of England. Not since the soldiers had come to Boston had Johnny removed his hat when the British flag went by, except once, when it had been knocked off his head by a soldier. He started to remove it now, for the first time and doubtless the last. Thought better of it. It was too late. He knew the shooting had begun. The sword in Earl Percy's hand flashed. There was a command which was instantly picked up and repeated and echoed and repeated again. The regimental drummer struck up. The artillery horses threw their weight against their collars. Wagoners cracked their whips, and the Scarlet Dragon swung forward, sluggishly at first, heading for the town gates. Thousands of separate feet merged into only one gigantic pair. Left, right, left, right. The earth shook to their rhythm. Johnny watched them pass. Every button was sewed on, every buckle in place. Every cartridge box held exactly 36 cartridges. Every musket had a bayonet, and there was not one old fowling piece among them. Every horse had 4 new shoes. It was a magnificent sight, but Johnny felt a little sick. What chance, what shadow of a chance had those poor, untrained, half-armed farmers at Concord? Oh, God, be with us now. But even as he prayed, he kept an eye out for the regimental markings on the men's uniforms. It was the 4th, the 23rd, and the 47th who were being sent out, plus 500 Marines, plus a small artillery train and a few baggage wagons. 1,200 for a guess. The drums throbbed. The heavy dragon marched on its thousands of feet, and now above the drums came the shrilling of fifes. They played a tune they always played when they wished to insult Yankees. For once more Yankee Doodle was going to town on a spanking stallion, and that forlorn feather in his cap, asking those unmilitary questions. Poor Yankee Doodle. Whatever could he do against this great scarlet dragon? 3. The hundreds gathered to see the departure of the brigade stood about gazing at the empty space they had occupied. Far away, growing faint and fainter, came wafting back the last sound of the tune they played. A man, standing by Johnny with clenched hands and head thrust down and out like a bull's, said thickly, "They go out by Yankee Doodle, but they'll dance to it before night." Johnny saw a group of women, and they were nodding their heads, whispering a prophecy. "Before night they'll be dancing." This catchphrase was everywhere. It did not seem to have gone from mouth to mouth, but from mind to mind. Old meeting struck 9. Earl Percy and his laggard brigade were gone. This day, this unreal day in which Boston waited hour upon hour for news, any news, good or bad, was well begun. Suddenly people were saying, "Have you heard? At sunrise this morning over at Lexington the British fired on us." No one seemed to know where this rumor had started, but it was everywhere. Although half of Gage's forces had left town for the battlefield, there were more officers than usual hanging about the streets and taverns. And their faces were so bland, and they reassured the people so glibly, that not a shot had been fired, not a person killed, and begged all and sundry so smoothly to keep calm and go to their shops or their homes. Johnny was confident that the British, as well as the inhabitants, had heard now the war had begun. and by noon little bands of soldiers appeared on the streets going quickly from house to house. Too late, General Gage had given orders that the leaders of the opposition should be arrested. But the leaders were all gone. The angry, frustrated soldiers might scare Sam Adams' black handmaiden out of her wits. They could break John Hancock's fence. But these gentlemen had quietly left Boston a month before. They stormed into Joseph Warren's house. He was gone, and so was Paul Revere. Not one of the principal leaders was left, and seemingly no rebel printers. Isaiah Thomas's shop was empty. He and his press had left the night before. At Eads and Gill's, where the Boston Gazette was published, they did grab young Peter Eads. His father and press had been smuggled out to Watertown. Robert Newman, suspected of having hung the lanterns in Christ's Church the night before, was thrown into jail, and John Pulling, merely suspected of having helped, was forced to hide in his grandmother's wine butt. Paul Revere's cousin was in jail, and every minute the temper of the soldiers was growing shorter, and a queer feeling of jubilation was apparent among the people. You couldn't see, you couldn't guess, why they began feeling so confident. Confidence was in the air. As soon as Johnny heard that arresting parties were on the streets, he sent a message to Uncle Lorne. Uncle Lorne had best make himself scarce. Soon after, having stood about the jail and noted exactly who was put in it, he himself headed for Salt Lane. There was not a person on the street, but at every window he saw a face. The lane itself had changed. He glanced about him and saw what was wrong. There was no little man in a blue coat observing Boston through a spyglass. The familiar sign had been torn down, stamped to kindling. The door of the shop was shattered. He went in. The presses were broken, the type pied. Upstairs, his and Rab's bed had been ripped open by bayonets. Frightened, he ran across the street. Aunt Jennifer sat in her kitchen. Half in her lap and half on the floor was an enormous feather bed. She was peacefully sticking on it a new ticking. The only unusual thing was the great number of feathers this deft housewife had carelessly spilled over her kitchen floor. Rabbit, enchanted with these new toys, was constantly picking up a feather, putting it in his hair, and saying, "Yankee doo." "They've been here?" asked Johnny. "Yes." "Are they gone?" "Not one in sight." "We got your message just as they were turning down Salt Lane." The feather bed began to heave on the floor. "You can come out now," Aunt Jennifer whispered to it. Out of the bottom rolled Uncle Lorne, choked with feathers and looking more bird than human. Rabbit shrieked, "Dada!" He evidently thought his father much improved. Still trembling, for Uncle Lorne was a timid man, he kissed his wife and hugged his child. "It was all I could think of," Aunt Jennifer said to Johnny. "Mr. Lorne just stood here and said he wasn't afraid to die. We could hear the men marching down the street. It was terrible. So I just popped him in and went on sewing." "Were the soldiers rough?" "Rough! They were furious." "Good," said Johnny grimly. "That means they are really scared. Something pretty awful has happened to all those men Gage has sent out. Some of the officers may know already, but the men have guessed it, and they are running about with uniforms unbuttoned and yelling, 'If they want a war, we'll give it to him. And they won't pay taxes, we'll collect in blood.'" "You don't say. Are you sure the fight's going for us?" "Pretty sure. I was down by the ferry slip and saw a British major coming over from Charlestown. Well, he had a civilian coat over his uniform, sort of disguised. And he tore off the boat and ran for the province house. He'd come to tell Gage Colonel Smith's and Percy's men are getting licked." "Boy, you're jumping at conclusions." "Not I. I saw his face. It was just done in and tied up with disgust. His uniform was a mess. His feelings had been hurt. People who have been winning battles don't go around with faces like that, but British officers who have been beaten by peasants and yokels do." "Oh, Johnny, I do like to hear you talk like that, but I'm not counting much on one man's face. Where are you off to?" "Beacon Hill. I've an idea that Major got back to Gage to tell him one thing. The British are going to try to get to Charlestown just the way he did, and under protection of the Somerset's guns. They won't backtrack the way they came. Too dangerous. If I've guessed it right, before long from Beacon Hill we'll be able to see them, running, and our men after them." "Johnny, here's half a mince pie for you. You're a real smart boy." Uncle Lorne came back from the bedroom where he, with Rabbit's help, had been picking off feathers.
Even if they hang me, he said in a proud tremolo, I will feel I have not lived in vain.
He was still pretty scared. Out on the street, Johnny met officers yelling at their men, trying to get them back into their barracks, striking at them even with the flat of their swords. You couldn't say the British regulars lacked fight. All they could talk about was how many skulking cowards and damned rebels they were going to kill. In one day, all was changed in Boston. On both sides, the gloves were off and the hands underneath were bloody. War had begun. The pastures and orchards back of Beacon Hill were crowded, and all eyes turned northward. Johnny was not the only person who had guessed that Percy would not attempt to get the remains of Smith's troops and his own brigade back through Cambridge, but only to Charlestown, where they could be protected by the Somerset's guns. Then Johnny saw running down Cambridge Road through the bushes on Charlestown Common a scurry of red ants. Had he really seen them or imagined them? But all about him, people were exclaiming, Look! There they are! Those red ants were British soldiers. To his left, the last moment of sunlight was dying. The day had been amazingly warm, but with night a fresh breeze came up off the ocean. Lights began to glimmer in Charlestown and on warships. Seemingly, there was nothing more to be seen from Beacon Hill. Silently, people turned to go to their houses. Look! Johnny cried. You could see the flash of musket fire, too far away to be heard. Fireflies swarming, hardly more than that. 4. Getting 2,000 men, or what was left of them, for gossip was saying they had been well chewed, into boats and back to Boston would create just the confusion Dr. Warren had promised. But it would not be easy for Johnny to slip over. The soldiers were cross and frightened. He would wait a little until they were more relaxed. Say, about midnight. Before him, lighted from top to bottom, he saw the light's house and he remembered Pumpkin's uniform. Dressed in that, he might slip aboard in the confusion. He went to the lights. In front of the house he saw wagons and carts and men loading them with furniture, chests, trunks, boxes, even old portraits. The lights were moving, and by night, and in a hurry. He went to the kitchen door. Mrs. Bessie, who certainly ought to have been superintending this moving, was sitting idly in the kitchen, doing nothing. Scylla sat beside her. She was doing nothing. Mrs. Bessie jerked her thumb toward the front of the house. Scared, she said. They are all going to London until this insurrection, as they call it, is over. The unicorn leaves at dawn tomorrow. Gage has given permission. Scylla, said Johnny, don't you go with them. Never. We all had a terrible fight this afternoon when word first came to us that Yankees had beaten them hollow. All the other servants are Tories and are going with them. But Mrs. Bessie and I are Whigs, and we are not going with them. In the end, Mr. Light said he was glad we are Whigs because he will leave us here to look after his property. Gage has promised nothing up here will be touched. But they don't want us around, can't bear the sight of us, Mrs. Bessie said smugly. The very sight of a good Whig makes them furious. Mr. Light did have another fit, just a little one. Miss Lavinia is afraid if she doesn't get her papa right out of town and off to London, he'll die. She always did like London better than Boston anyway. They are leaving tonight, and fast. What's his honor going to do? Is he? Mrs. Bessie's lips curled. She'll go with them. She will not, said Scylla. Miss Lavinia has gone down to Hancock's Wharf to ask Ma to let her take her. But Ma couldn't give her away, just as though she was a kitten. Miss Lavinia was standing in the doorway from the dining room to the kitchen. She had on a black cloak with the hood to it over her head. She stood a moment looking about and said nothing. Johnny was on his feet. He knew he would never forget her. Never. Even when he was an old man, he would remember Lavinia Light, standing, framed in that doorway, saying nothing. Her eyes were angry and tired. The chisel mark was deep between the low-sweeping black brows. He had never seen her look so worn and old, and never before been more aware of her beauty. "Izana is going with me," she said at last. "Your mother, Scylla, has too many kittens." "Miss Lavinia," said Scylla, "you can't do that."
"Can't? Your mother signed the paper, and you're a wicked girl to stand in the way of your sister's good fortune.
A little diffidently, Izana herself emerged from behind the lady's great dark skirts.
"Izana," said Scylla gently, "you can't go off and leave me like this. It's no matter what Mother says. Look, dear, if you go to London, maybe you will never come back. Izana, don't go away from me."
Lavinia was smiling under her dark hood.
"I will leave the decision entirely to her. She shall be perfectly free to choose between us. Precious, would you rather go with me to London and be a great lady and wear silks and jewels and ride in coaches, or stay here and be just another poor working girl?" And then, to make the choice doubly hard for the child, she added a little maliciously, "Which do you love most, Scylla or me?"
Still Izana said nothing. But even in her silence, Johnny could detect something of her desire for drama. At the moment, silence was more dramatic than anything she could say. "Izzy is no good," thought Johnny. "She'll go." Scylla was standing quietly, well away from the child. She was too proud to make any further appeal to her. Perhaps, like Johnny, she knew what the answer would be.
"Well," said Lavinia, "I haven't got all day. Which do you love the most?"
Izana began to cry. It was perfectly natural crying. Not even Johnny could believe it was done for effect.
"I don't know," she sobbed.
"Which would you rather be, a common person like your sister or a fine lady?"
"Fine lady," she sniffled, and went on dreamily. "And I'll have a gray pony and a pony cart. I've got the gold locket already."
Her hand went to her throat. Next she'd be saying she wanted a little sailboat. Even now she was only reflecting old desires of Scylla's. Izana never could think up anything for herself.
"Yes, dear, you will, when I am Lady Prior Morton and you my little protégé."
She explained to the others, "I've been betrothed to marry my lord ever since I last came back from London. Papa is a very sick man. He could never live through a civil war over here, never. He doesn't want to leave all his property to the mob, but what does it matter? My lord is so rich. This miserable house, our ships, shops are nothing to him. And my lord never liked it that my papa was in trade. Until now, papa would not give up his trade, nor could I bear to leave him." She turned to Scylla. "And I promise you, I will be in a position to give your sister the best care and training."
"Training," said Johnny. "What's she going to be trained for?"
"Izana shall be an actress. I would have been myself, but my station in life prevented me. And then I am too tall. And besides, I can't act. Izana shall be the toast of London. You'll be proud some day. Even over here in this dreary wilderness, you shall hear her name and boast that you once knew her."
Mrs. Bessie said smartly, "I'd welcome the day I was proud to know that, Izzy."
Scylla was not taking the parting as hard as Johnny would have expected. Now he knew that she had been through the worst of it months before when first the two sisters had come to the lights. She had lost Izana long ago.
"Now, Scylla," said Miss Lavinia, "I want you to have some time alone with Izana. You've been a good girl, Scylla, better than Izana. But happens she is what I fancy. Now go with her and help her pack her duds."
Scylla said nothing, but curtsied and went upstairs with Izana, who was once more sobbing.
"You too," said Lavinia irritably to Mrs. Bessie. "You leave me, for I must talk to Johnny alone."
Mrs. Bessie heaved herself up out of her comfortable chair and shut the door after her. The young woman sat at last and murmured, more to herself than to Johnny,
"I must talk to you, Jonathan Light Tremaine."
Johnny raised his eyes in amazement.
"I wanted to tell you before we left. First of all, Papa never meant to trick you out of your cup. He honestly thought it was an attempt at swindle. I mean that someone here in Boston stole the cup and then found a boy to pretend to be a long-lost relative, and used the cup as proof. Your mother did leave Boston with one of those cups. Papa did not mention that fact in court, There really were five.
He implied no more than four ever came to this country.
He didn't imply it, said Johnny. He swore it in court.
Oh, well, what of it? Let me talk. You see, he never knew that his niece, Vinnie Light, had a child. He had it from your father's family that both she and her husband died of cholera almost as soon as they reached Marseille. You see, your father was a naval surgeon, a prisoner of war while here in Boston.
Oh, nothing very much, she added scornfully. No great fortune or title.
And Vinnie Light fell in love with him. He was everywhere in society that year, although a prisoner of war. And, of course, the Lights wouldn't hear of a marriage.
He, a Frenchman and a Catholic.
And they told her if she ran off with him, she would be cut off, and she was never, never to return.
But she did.
Vinnie was so wild she went right ahead. A ship's captain married them. Then his family, of course, would have none of her, she being a heretic. And then he died. They sent word to Papa, your grandfather was dead, that both had died. But his family sent Vinnie to a convent, hoping the sisters would convert her, and there, 3 months after your father died, you were born. You were born in a convent in the south of France.
Odd, isn't it?
Why do you call my mother Vinnie?
We all did. Vinnie Light, the wildest, handsomest girl in Boston. I was only a schoolgirl, but she was so beautiful and so gay.
Oh, if you could have but seen her.
But I did.
He remembered the sweet, sad face of his sick mother. Was the wild and beautiful Vinnie Light really the same woman? His mother patiently sewing and sewing to keep life in her son's body. She wanted no more life for herself. Teaching him to read, making him those smocks. Knowing she had changed so much in such few years, she dared, as Mrs. Tremaine, return to Boston so her boy could grow up there, learn a decent trade. He thought of her agreeing with Mr. Lapham for his indenture, smiling as she told him that when she died he was to go there.
"When I first saw you," Miss Lavinia went on, "I noticed one thing, but it set me thinking. I did nothing for a while, but this spring I asked one of my father's captains, bound for Marseille, to feel about and find out the truth. I did so behind Papa's back. Papa was already too ill to be bothered, but I knew he would want to do right.
Like swearing in court there never were but four Light cups?"
She colored angrily.
"Please let me do the telling. Don't you dare criticize the best man ever lived."
Johnny had his own opinion on that.
"What was the one thing?" he asked.
"The way your hair turns down upon your forehead, that little peak."
She was a dark girl. That widow's peak on her was very striking. "And then that day in Mr. Dana's court. I did notice you walked like her, light and wild, like a panther, or," she shrugged, "maybe only like a tomcat." "I admired my cousin so. I may tend to exaggerate her qualities."
"And what did your captain find out?"
"What I have just told you. And one thing more. Your father, the naval surgeon, was ashamed to be a prisoner of war. He told folks here his name was Latour. That's why your name Tremaine meant nothing to us."
"That is my true name?"
"Yes. But I haven't much time to talk. Only yesterday I told Papa. He's too ill to speak to you himself. He does want you to know that he did not deliberately cheat you, steal your cup.
Mother did take it with her."
"Yes. It belonged to her. And her maid, Mrs. Denny, went with her. It was Margaret Denny who got her and you out of the convent and onto a ship her brother commanded and so to Townsend, Maine. That's where I grew up. I remember Aunt Margaret. She died just before Mother took me to Boston."
"Yes. And Papa says I am to promise you that he will write the whole thing out in black and white."
"When the war's over," she shrugged, "you can put in quite a claim for property, if there's any property left, which I doubt. Anything more you wish to ask me?"
"Yes.
What relationship are you to me? What ought I to call you?" She laughed out loud.
"Mercy, I don't know. What am I? Why, I suppose I'm sort of a cousin, but you'd better call me Aunt. Aunt Lavinia. He said it tentatively. Aunt Lavinia?